This paid program may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. The Defense Logistics Agency, DLA, provides full-spectrum logistics support to soldiers, sailors, airmen, marines, and civilians around the world every day and for every major conflict over the past five decades. Logistics is a cost driver that must be managed with deliberate precision. DLA's readiness to respond to warfighter needs is built on an integrated supply chain that must be efficient and effective. As stewards of the Department of Defense's resources, the agency must go beyond simply responding to demands to more effectively anticipating them. Over the next decade, DLA will find its comprehensive logistics services needed more than ever in new and challenging ways. The very nature of envisioned threats and conflicts combined with increased fiscal challenges demands a logistics response that is agile and joint in nature, marked by innovation and best practices. What are DLA's strategic priorities? How is DLA working to reduce cost while improving support to the warfighter? And what about DLA's role in providing humanitarian assistance and disaster relief support? We'll explore these questions and so much more with our very special guest, Vice Admiral Mark Karnacek, Director of the Defense Logistics Agency. So, Admiral, welcome to the show. It's great to have you.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Admiral, before we delve into specific initiatives, I'd like you to provide our listeners with some context. Perhaps you could provide us with a brief overview of the history, mission, and continued evolution of the Defense Logistics Agency, DLA.
Yeah, thanks. That's a great question and a great place to start. Last year, we just had our 50th birthday, so we are not all that old in terms of the military services that are 200 plus years old. Conceived back in the 60s as sort of a more efficient way to supply the services with the logistics needs that, they all need that are common to all of them. Mm-hmm. So stood up back in the early 60s, and we've evolved over time to support all of the traditional supply chains that any military or, frankly, civilian logistician would sort of know and understand. So, items like food, medicines, medical surgical equipment, fuel is one of our big supply chains, mm-hmm. Construction equipment, construction supplies, uniforms, and all the things that our service people sort of wear on their person or use out in the field, and then repair parts for, land systems, maritime systems, and air systems. So really the whole range of logistics items, and we manage them sort of cradle to grave.
So, Admiral, with such a vital mission, I'd like to get a sense of the scale of operation of DLA. How is it organized? What's the size of your budget, your funding mechanism, and the number of employees that work with you?
Yeah, let me take the last one first. Sure. We have right in the neighborhood of about 27,000 people, and they are in probably close to 30 countries and 48 of the 50 states. So we're a global organization. We're funded via something called a working capital fund, mm-hmm. which is just sort of a revolving fund of money and material. So we have authority from the department to make lead time investments in things, to have them positioned where our forces need them. So we sell them, truly sell them to our service customers, and they reimburse us, which goes right back into our working capital fund to buy the next thing that we need. So it's a simple funding mechanism. I mean, even a guy like me who's not an accountant or knows nothing about business can easily understand that. We have to keep a certain amount of cash on hand to pay our bills. So that's really the only thing we need to watch. We don't want to run out of sort of working capital to buy things or pay our bills. Then in terms of the size of DLA, in terms of the material that we buy, we're right around $40 billion in sales of things. And in terms of cost of our operation, we're about $5 to $6 billion. So that our sort of two big financial lines of operation are the things that we buy. That's about $40 billion. And then the cost of our operation, that's me, it's all my people, it's all of our infrastructure, all of our IT, all of our transportation, the things that sort of enable us getting all that material. Our biggest commodity is fuel. That's probably half of that $40 billion. And then in terms of right after that, food is a big one at right around 4 to 5. Pharmaceuticals is another big one, right around 4 to 5. And then the rest of them make up the rest of that 10. So uniforms, repair parts, construction equipment, et cetera. So, but we're a big buyer of fuel. We're about the size of Delta and Northwest in terms of the amount of fuel that we buy. About 130 million barrels a year.
Admiral, I'd like to focus more on your specific responsibilities as the director of DLA. What are your duties in the areas under your purview? And more interestingly, how do you support the overall mission of the U.S. Department of Defense?
Mm-hmm. Very simply, I am very focused on understanding what my customers' requirements are in terms of some operational outcome, and then arraying everything behind that such that we're achieving that outcome. So real simple in terms of our support in Afghanistan, it's to have the requisite amount of food and fuel on hand to meet the operational commander's needs, whatever those needs are, and then having all those other supply chains positioned to do that. So from about 50,000 feet, it's not all that difficult. It's figuring out what it is your customers want, what the outcome that you're trying to achieve, and then us figuring out on the back end how to achieve that at the least cost. So we're very mindful that that working capital fund is not ours. Mm-hmm. You know, our service customers pay those bills. So to the extent that we can, we're very mindful of how much things cost. So if I can sell it for 10% less this year than I did the year before that and get the same operational outcome, that's exactly what we want to do. So that, in a nutshell, is really what my responsibilities are and the responsibilities, those 27,000 military and civilian folks that work for me.
Well, understanding the needs of your customers, the warfighters, it's got to have some challenges associated with it. I'd like to explore those. What are, say, your top three challenges, and how have you sought to address them?
Well, certainly one of the big challenges is, we're going to have to, achieve the same operational outcome that we're getting today with a lot less money. Mm-hmm. You know, the Budget Control Act took around $500 billion out of our budget of the DOD program, and with sequestration, that's a number somewhere in the neighborhood of another 500. So as Winston Churchill said, gentlemen, we're out of money. It's time to start thinking. So it has been relatively easy over the past 12 years, in spite of some of the physical and, diplomatic difficulties of supporting a large ground force in both Iraq and Afghanistan, but all overcome when you got good people working hard to just go figure it out. So I would say the fiscal challenges aren't daunting, but they're challenging. Really, in my business and what I run, it all revolves around money. So I would say that is probably the biggest challenge that I face and probably the overarching challenges. The rest of them are just sort of the day-to-day mm-hmm. issues you have with your customer base, with your suppliers, with all sorts of different ways you get pulled when you're leading a big organization.
I was wondering, because along with the challenges you've encountered and money and the fiscal realities of today being the biggest one, there's got to be some unanticipated or unexpected surprises that you've faced since taking over DLA. I'd be interested. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I've been in about 36 years, and I've been a customer of DLA for most of that time. Mm-hmm. So this is my very first tour in DLA, and I always knew that DLA was a big, big organization, but I never really understood the scope and the reach and, frankly, the power that DLA has in terms of logistics power. So that was probably my biggest realization, is that how big DLA is, and when you're swinging a $40 billion logistics sledgehammer, you can get after some pretty big problems, and we can do that. When you're a big, powerful logistics organization and you have lots of excellent senior leader guidance and then the money, you can do some great things and you can do them very quickly. So,
you mentioned leadership a couple of times in that response, and I actually want to get your view of leadership. What makes an effective leader? And more importantly, who's influenced your leadership style?
Boy, I have been very fortunate in that I don't think I've ever worked for a bad leader. But the guys that come to mind most recently are my old boss at U.S. Transportation Command, a guy named General Duncan McNabb. His boss before that, a guy named General Norton Schwartz, who was the Transcom commander and then the Air Force chief of staff. My last boss, General Duncan McNabb, and you'll see that in my guiding principles in the back of this director's guidance. I didn't think those up. He used to write those down. He would say them repeatedly. So I made a note to write them all down. Things like, I trust you to get things done. So do it your way. You don't have to do it my way, but just ensure it gets done or do it yourself. Things, statements like, nobody knows this stuff like we do. I want you to start acting like it. So what that means when you're in the logistics business, rather than ask your warfighting customer to spend 2 seconds figuring out what his requirements are, just help him out and figure it out for him and get moving. Prioritize, do it your own way, get it done, I trust you. So all those guiding principles is really what I've learned from a lot of those great leaders.
How is DLA working to reduce cost while improving support to the warfighter? We will ask Vice Admiral Mark Karnicek, Director of the Defense Logistics Agency, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. What is fast government, and how can focusing on time and speed deliver real and lasting benefits? How are changing work habits and technology decreasing the federal government's real estate footprint? And how are VA and HUD working to end chronic homelessness among veterans? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. We go beyond the buzz to introduce and connect our readers to actual public sector executives who are changing the way government does business. All of this and more in the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine. Order your free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Vice Admiral Mark Karnicek, Director of the Defense Logistics Agency. So, Admiral, DLA is defined by its mission, its people, and ultimately its support of the warfighter. As DLA director, you've outlined a strategic direction for the organization. Would you give us an overview of that direction?
Yeah, obviously, it's all about our customers. So our theme here for my director's guidance since I got there in late 2012, is that over my tour here at DLA, we're going to significantly improve performance and performance as defined by our customers, whoever they are, while we dramatically reduce cost. You have to give everybody a target, and then you have to fully empower them to start improving performance and dramatically reducing cost. So on the improving performance side, that's really the easy part. Well, the easy part is to figure out what improved performance looks like, and that's not something we define. And then you have to figure out a plan to actually improve performance. And I'll tell you, when you're in the logistics business, improving performance is not all that difficult if you sort of stick to the basics. And when you're in a machine that buys things, and that's largely what DLE is, we are an acquisition machine, you have to buy enough, you have to buy it on time, and then you have to make sure it gets there. So sounds simple, but that's what everybody needs to be focused on, and I think we are focused on that. So baseline your customer's performance and then deliver on time, right place, right quantity, right thing at the least cost, which brings me to the reducing cost stuff. We have two big cost centers. We have the cost of the stuff we buy, and then we have our operating costs. So we're going to take a big crack at that. We've coined a little phrase here, 13 and 6. That's $13 billion over the next 6 years. So what that means to folks that really don't understand a lot of working capital fund accounting mumbo jumbo, that means between now and 6 years from now, DLA will deliver improved performance at $13 billion less cost. So that means our customers will get equal to or improved cost, but they'll be paying a lot less for it. So you do that by talking to your industry partners with regard to understanding behaviors that we either do by custom or by regulation that cost the government more money, and telling us where they are, and then working with them to pull those costs out, reducing the amount of inventory that we carry. We have a lot of extra inventory, which implies a lot of extra carrying costs, and a lot of excess infrastructure costs. And again, when you're in the inventory business and you're running a working capital fund, or you're a retailer or a car business, I mean, you don't want to be stuck with a lot of stock at the end of the year, because that goes right back against your bottom line. So the key for us is to buy only the inventory that we need and no more, and then make sure that it's moving, that it's working hard, that we're not storing a lot of stuff that we simply don't need. And that's really fundamentally it.
I'd like to pick up on the recently unveiled 13-in-6 strategy. Yeah. And you mentioned some of the things you're doing around that. But more importantly, what was the impetus of issuing the strategy? And how does it sort of capitalize or build upon your 2012 10-in-5 approach?
Mm-hmm. Well, when I got there in an odd year, 10-in-5. So we only had we got there in a program review year. So we only had 5 years to look at. So it was actually 10% in 5 years, which coincidentally equaled $10 billion. So when you get to the full program here, you add another year to that. So it's 6 years, and that just happens to be $13 billion in 6 years. I wanted everybody to understand that the country expects us to do that. The president expects us to do that. The secretary expects us to do that. So rather than wait for, you know, guidance from above to cut, I figured we would get out ahead of that and be a little more forehanded with regard to what it is we were doing. Because it takes you a little while to get some inertia here. Probably takes you a good year before you really put money in the bank in terms of savings. So I figured the sooner we started, the better off we would be. I wanted it real simple. You know, when I talk about the five things we're going to do, it's to decrease direct material costs, decrease operating costs, reduce inventory, improve customer service, and then get to the spot called audit readiness. Yeah. And again, everybody is part of that. Industry is a huge part of it on the material cost side. We have a lot of work to do internally to ensure that we cost, we're achieving that effect at the least operational cost, and a whole host of things. So underneath those five, there's many, many sort of branches and sequels with regard to strategies and how we're going to do that.
Yeah, and I'd like to pick up on at least one now. I'd like to sort of unveil each one of them a sure. little bit and talk a little bit about them, and particularly the material costs and reduction there. Would you tell us about some of those strategies you're pursuing in that area?
A big one that I learned back in my Navy days was something called a reverse auction. If you've ever been in an auction, or you've ever bid on eBay, I guess, you're online, you're bidding. You don't see everybody else's bids, but you know you're not the high bidder. So if you want it, you got to determine in your own mind how much you're willing to pay for it. Well, this is a pricing tool that we use for qualified suppliers, and that's the pricing. So instead of a sealed bid or a best and final that we negotiate with each of the suppliers, this runs just like it's an online auction. We do it for virtually anything that is more than $100,000, so goods, services, fuel, medicine, all that stuff. So the folks in the auction, and you only need two to have an auction. Very often we have more than two, three to five to six, and we run it just like a regular auction. So we have a sort of a target where we want to start, and the suppliers bid against one another. So unbeknownst to us, there's all sorts of deliberations going on in their boardrooms with regard to how low they can actually get. Mm-hmm. So what it does is it lets everybody else see everybody else's sort of margin and how low can you go. And again, our rule to start with was that any buy that was over $100,000, we were going to subject that to a reverse auction. Over the past year, we've done over 5,000 reverse auctions. No kidding, auditable. No kidding savings, we're at about $1.8 billion. What we found is they work very well where there's a lot of competition, obviously, where there's a pretty robust sort of base, where the margins are, what I mean profit, is probably in the neighborhood of 10% or a little more. Obviously, where the dollar value is pretty big and where the contract is of a longer term.
And could you give us an example of what kind of products were services?
Yeah, well, you name it. I mean, we ran a bulk fuel buy that we only saved about, you know, 3% on. But 3% on a contract that's a couple billion dollars is real money. We had another contract that we ran, or an auction that we ran a couple months ago for a medical prime vendor, medical supplies. It's a 10-year contract worth about $10 billion. We say 5%. 5% of 10 billion is a big number.
I'd like to transition to, as I understand it, DLA manages 26 distribution centers worldwide.
Correct.
Is that right?
Correct.
And I think you'd mentioned, or I'd heard that about $2 billion a year to maintain that infrastructure. Yeah. I'd like to transition to understand how you're trying to reduce your infrastructure costs. Could you tell us a little bit about that? And more particularly, how does the strategic network optimization fit in?
That's a great question. Again, we're at about 26 different spots worldwide. In 1992, when we took the distribution missions from all of our service customers, we got that transferred to us. We were at 26 different sites. So a generation later, we're still in largely the same number of sites. Now, we were in Afghanistan. We weren't in Afghanistan then. We used to have a place in Memphis. We don't have that. So there's been some changes on the edges there, but largely we're still in 26 different places. And when you look at all that is sort of taken place over the last generation, we think it's probably time to take a very hard look at what that network looks like. Mm-hmm. Folks in private industry rearrange their network pretty often, and that's on the decrease operating cost side of the house. So what we're going to do is put the inventory that we decide to keep in our best, most advantageously located least cost distribution centers, get rid of the inventory we don't need, and knock down a bunch of buildings. Mm-hmm. Last year, 40% of DLA's inventory was in more than one place, which means we had a lot of inventory all over the place. If you talk to FedEx, they'll tell you they can have anything, big or small, moved anywhere in the United States in 5 days. Mm-hmm. So using that as sort of a guiding principle, how does that apply to us? So if it was 40% in more than one place, this year it's only 2%. Following sort of a tried and true business model that minimizes the amount of inventory you carry and really leverages a fabulous distribution and transportation system, we're going to put most of our wholesale inventory at one of four places: Susquehanna, San Joaquin, Warner Robins to a lesser extent, and the other big one is Red River. Mm-hmm. Red River has sort of the heavy army. Susquehanna has the Navy, parts of the Air Force, and the light army on the East Coast. And then in San Joaquin, we have sort of the Navy, the Air Force, and just a little army. So when you look at how we're supporting customers, we're going to do it from one of four places. So the only inventory that we will have out close to customers at, you know, Hill Air Force Base or Tinker Air Force Base or the shipyard in Pearl Harbor will be retail inventory, inventory that supports that industrial effort where sort of time is of the essence, and then back up those retail inventories with the wholesale inventory. So what does that all mean in terms of fewer infrastructure? If you go out to San Joaquin, we're actually in two places, Tracy and Sharp. We will reduce enough inventory and have enough sort of fallow space at Tracy so we can move off of Sharp completely and demolish between 6 and 8 World War II vintage warehouses that cost us a fortune to maintain. I mean, every time you put a roof on those buildings, it costs $1 million. So if you don't need the inventory, it's excess to our needs, and you can achieve the same outcome. In other words, it's all about achieving that operational outcome at least cost. That's what we're going to do. So when you multiply that across the DOD, for DLA anyway, we're repositioning inventory. We're making much better use of transportation. And because we have less inventory, we're able to get out of a lot of old infrastructure. So that's really what it is.
And you mentioned the connection between inventory and infrastructure. In other words, needing the buildings to store the inventory that you're going to need or potentially need. And I'd like to understand a little bit about some of the challenges of both, you know, reducing the inventory, but knowing what the customer needs and making sure you have access to it. And then how does that bleed into, saying, reducing your footprint geographically?
Yeah, this is all about managing risk in an era of uncertainty here. And, of course, everybody who has been around the military knows that we've been through a lot of sort of surprises over the past 12 years with regard to logistics. So, you know, you kind of want to hedge your bets here. You don't want to get too thin. And some of this is just judgment, leadership, and the rest is just arithmetic. For example, when you look at DLA's inventories, about $14 billion, we think we can achieve the same effect with about 8 and not incur any additional risk. I have wonderful people that work for me that are just smart as whips that can look out next month, next year, 5 years from now, and using the information that we have, figure this is what our requirement is that we know, and we add probably 6 to 12 months worth of cushion just to ensure if we miss, we're not going to drive the ship aground, and the rest you get rid of. So really, it's no more simple than that. The hard part is making that decision. I mean, this is information that's been known to us and, frankly, the other services for quite some time. It just requires, the leadership team to make the decision. That's what we're going to do, and that's what we're going to do at DLA.
What is DLA doing to reduce its fuel cost? We will ask Vice Admiral Mark Karnacek, Director of the Defense Logistics Agency, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. What is fast government, and how can focusing on time and speed deliver real and lasting benefits? How can serendipitous collision change the way agencies do business? How are changing work habits and technology decreasing the federal government's footprint? Get your latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. We go beyond the buzz to introduce and connect our readers to actual public sector executives who are changing the way government does business. All of this and more in the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine. Get your free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Vice Admiral Mark Karnacek, Director of the Defense Logistics Agency. Admiral, I'd like to discuss DLA's presence and support in Afghanistan. Would you tell us more about DLA's forward presence in this area and the key logistics challenges you faced, particularly with the Northern Distribution Network?
Right. Yeah, and that's a great question. All of my supply chains feed customer requirements in Afghanistan. Band-aids, construction equipment, construction supplies. But three big sort of lines of operation that I pay a lot of attention to are fuel. You got to have enough fuel. And food is another one. And they are commodities that I pay a lot of attention to because we use them in great volumes there. Mm-hmm. Hundreds of thousands, maybe close to a million gallons of fuel a day. And probably in the neighborhood of about $500,000 worth of food every day. They're not commodities that you can fly. So they have to travel on the ground. And very often they travel from very, very far away places. So you have an entire network that has up to 15 countries in it. So vital to ensure that that network is stitched together. So the commander on the ground isn't worried about running out of food or running out of fuel. And again, we pay a lot of attention to that. And that distribution operation has changed drastically over the past probably 5 to 6 years in Afghanistan specifically. Used to be the big two ways in for a lot of the heavy commodities was through Pakistan, things that had to move on the ground, the big commodities, unit equipment, and then a lot of the things that were either you couldn't put on the ground or needed to fly would fly in for probably close to 2 years, I would say. So the only way in was via that northern route that started in the Baltics or the Caucasus and then made that long, arduous route on the ground through, the Baltics, Lithuania, Estonia, Latvia, Belarus, Russia, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, Azerbaijan, and Georgia. So it was a fairly, not a complex network, but it transited a lot of countries. So it was really took a lot of sort of fine tuning and sort of hands on dial turning to ensure that that network was flowing because it was long, expensive. But again, our folks at U.S. Transportation Command and U.S. Central Command did a great job to ensure those DLA commodities moved when they were supposed to move. But again, it's something that bears watching. There's issues with that whole network, all those nations. There's weather. There are issues with customs. There are, you name it, when it comes to logistics hurdles, we got some pretty high logistics hurdles to sort of leap over to get into Afghanistan. But the gang, the team, if you will, the log nation, the transportation nation, and that's a lot of different commands and a lot of hardworking folks, have really, I don't want to say made it look easy, but logistics has not hampered any operation in Afghanistan, as far as I know. The third mission there is, and this is a DLA mission that a lot of people don't talk about, is something called disposition, which is essentially destroying things. So a whole lot of stuff in Afghanistan will not come out because it's not economical to come out, or we simply don't have a requirement for it here back in the States. So again, we want to make sure that we have the requisite capacity based on a somewhat nebulous or unknown requirement. So when the commander on the ground doesn't need something, DLA is postured to destroy it, sell it, scrap it, or whatever the right procedure is. And we're at close to, I want to say, 15 sites in Afghanistan, from huge industrial sites to small sites at the smaller forward operating bases. And our capacity there is to destroy about 60 million pounds of scrap a month, and then destroy up to about 500 vehicles a month if we have to. So the folks are doing great over there. That's largely a civilian contractor operation with a very small military footprint. So wrap up in Afghanistan, three big DLA lines of operation: food, fuel, and disposition.
And disposition, what's the timetable on that, do you think? Do you guys have an idea?
Well, I mean, as far as I know, we have to support, you know, the president's direction to be largely concluded here in December of 14. So, again, the requirement is a little nebulous there with regard to what it is we're going to give away, mm-hmm. in terms of bases we'll turn over to the Afghans, or bases that we will return to some pristine condition, what will go, what will stay. So from a DLA perspective, I want to be ready for all contingencies. So we're probably a little over capacity now. We're only running at about 25%. But my sense is, as we get into early next year and then through the spring and the summer, requirements will grow, and I want to be ready for them.
I'd like to talk, because the services are obviously your obvious customers. It's the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, Coast Guard. Right. But you also do some non-DOD customers, right? You have some non-DOD customers?
We do. For example, the mission in Iraq, we support them with our food and our fuel contract. And we're delighted to do that, and we'll do that as long as the State Department would like us to be there. So we have a lot of those sort of smaller boutique agreements. But writ large, our big formal agreement to support is with FEMA. So we have an agreement with FEMA to supply them with 200,000 gallons of gas per day, and then 1 million meals per day, and then, frankly, whatever else is they ask us for. So in Hurricane Sandy, we were well above 200,000 gallons of gas. But again, when you have a great sort of contractor network, and there happens to be lots of fuel that's already refined, you can sort of turn up the dial and make 200,000, 800,000, which I think is what we did. We supplied FEMA for probably 6 or 7 days with 1 million meals a day, and then with medicine, with power generation, with pumps to pump out basements and tunnels, and all that sort of stuff. But the key to this relationship on food and fuel is it's all sort of prescripted. So these are all contracts that we have sort of in wait. When a disaster hits the homeland, we break the glass and we start responding.
Are there any unique challenges, or what are some of the unique challenges with dealing with clients or partners outside of DOD?
Again, it's showing your non-traditional customers where you add value and letting them decide what it is they want you to do. And I think our relationship with FEMA grew out of Hurricane Katrina, when our government writ large just had a tough time responding to, a major disaster. Boy, every time we have one of those, or, every time we exercise, we sort of do a dry run with those, I mean, the response from FEMA just gets better and better. Mm-hmm. And I think they did an outstanding job in Hurricane Sandy, and we were just happy to be part of their success.
It's obvious to me your commitment to customer service and lower costs are front and center. But you also mentioned in one of your priorities DLA's effort to improve its financial processes, the goal of audit readiness, if you will. Right. Would you tell us about your efforts in this area, and how, which I found very interesting, how are you cultivating the culture of judiciousness?
Yeah, that is that's an all-hands effort. So as often as I can, I tell my folks that have grown up, many of them, in this sort of time of fiscal plenty due to the war, that the next investment that you want to make ought to have some return on investment in terms of a lesser cost or some fabulously improved customer outcome, or I don't want you to spend that money. So the next big IT fix that we want to inject ought to have some return on investment that's at least 5 to 1. Not 2 to 1, because if you make a mistake, you're, minus 2 to 1. In other words, you've spent a lot of money and not really achieved anything. And that's an all-hands effort. And so it's more than me just saying it. We reward it every quarter. So folks that hit a homer saving a lot of money, we reward them appropriately in front of the entire agency. So commercial packaging really is, in my view, as good or better than how we package things. So every time you ask a contractor to do something different than what they traditionally do, it costs more money. So every time we ask a contractor to take a Fram oil filter out of its box, put it in one of our boxes, costs us about $4. Well, we sell a lot of oil filters. So when you look at that across everything, the millions of things that we sell every day, we think we can save probably $120 million a year just by keeping things in the boxes they come in. So a lot of this stuff is common sense, but folks need to understand that that's important, that if they have a good idea, leadership will not only take a look at it, we'll do it, and we'll do it relatively quickly, and then you'll be recognized for that. So that's kind of how we're doing it, and that's a good example of folks just using their heads. And generally, you talk to your people, and they've had these ideas for years. They either didn't get any traction or it just never went anywhere. So that's how we're doing it. That's how you inculcate that culture of judiciousness with your folks by, you know, you not only got to talk the talk, you got to walk the walk with regard to recognizing folks and rewarding them for it.
So that's the culture of judiciousness. What are you doing in the area of audit readiness, sir?
Oh, audit readiness. Yeah, that's one that it's all about stewardship. I mean, I need to be able to tell my gray-haired grandmother that every nickel that we spend is having the proper outcome that we intend with regard to our customers, and then that I can account for that dollar, that nickel, or whatever. And right now, we can't do that. I mean, I'm confident that there's not a lot of leakage here. I just can't prove it. Auditors are great people, but they're not going to take your word for it. So essentially, it's being able to factually prove what it is you're doing. Do you have the right authority to write that contract? Did the stuff that you wrote in that contract, did that actually get to the intended customer? Can you prove it? Show me how you paid the bill and show me how you closed out that contract. We're going to be ready. We're going to be ready by fiscal year 15.
So, Admiral, you mentioned that DLA procures something on the order of $46 billion in services and products. And of that, half, maybe $20 billion, goes to fuel. Would you tell us more about DLA's efforts to reduce its fuel operational cost and improve the agency's fuel distribution network? And more specifically, how does the conversion from JP-8 to commercial-grade jet fuel help in your efforts?
We buy military specification fuel now. The Air Force has done a lot of great work on their sort of fuel engineering side. And the Air Force is our big customer when it comes to fuel, then the Navy, then the Army. And we sell largely JP-8 to them. That's really, it's commercial jet fuel with a different flash point, a different sort of freeze point. I don't understand a lot about cracking fuel, but folks that really understand that. So what that requires is that you have to get refiners to do something different than they normally do. And then you have to store fuel that's different than everybody else's fuel. So when you do that, we have a lot of infrastructure here to the tune of about 600 sites where we store military specification fuel. We have them here in the States. We have them overseas. We have them in Japan and Guam and Singapore, you name it. We have a lot of fuel floating around. So the Air Force has decided that they can achieve that same operational mission effect by using commercial jet fuel. So the implication, it makes you more ready because that fuel is available all over the world because everybody uses jet fuel. Everybody doesn't use military jet fuel. But so the readiness implications are you're more ready because you don't have to refine fuel somewhere far away and then move it to the operational point of need. So that makes you more ready. So that's a good thing. The second thing is, if you don't have this unique requirement for military specification fuel, you can sort of rely on commercial industry to store it for you. So we can get out of a lot of old legacy World War II vintage below ground storage tanks that frankly are an environmental accident waiting to happen, and they cost a lot to own and operate. So this effort by the Air Force will save over 20 years, hundreds of millions of dollars in infrastructure costs, plus it costs a little less. So I think that is a huge sort of muscle movement that will A, make us more ready than we are today, and really reduce the cost of everything that we do.
Well, sir, I wanted to talk to you about counterfeit parts and what you're doing to secure your supply chain and to monitor counterfeit parts and get them out of the supply chain.
Yeah, there is an entire industry in the Far East that counterfeits parts. Mm-hmm. They rip apart old components. They get something that looks like what it is that we want. They mark it, and then it makes it into this sort of aftermarket. And you've read stories periodically about, you know, a bad component making it to a missile system, to an air mobility command airplane, to a submarine, to a ship. And these are components that are used. They're not very expensive in and of themselves, but they go in higher assemblies that really sort of decide which way the rocket goes or which way the ship goes. So we take that very seriously. Probably the commodity that is most at risk or most susceptible to counterfeiting are microcircuits. So we're really attacking that on three fronts, four actually. One is that we're only buying from folks that we certify as customers or suppliers that are on the up and up. Mm-hmm. So we're not real interested in buying electronic components from somebody that is selling stuff out of their garage. The second thing that we're doing is instituting software here that, much like what the credit card industry does, looks for anomalies in the in sort of the buying pattern. In other words, if we have a supplier here who only has a post office box and is fairly new to the system, that should raise a flag in terms of who it is we're buying from. So just like a credit card system that recognizes something a little odd in your buying patterns, calls you on the phone and says, did you make a purchase in Hong Kong? Well, no, I'm in Philadelphia. So that's not a good one. So software that does that, and probably the biggest change in what we're doing is we're putting plant DNA on all the microcircuits that we buy. And that is a technology that a company here has figured out. So each microcircuit that you'll see and open up a piece of electronics at home, your stereo, your cell phone or whatever, that'll have a microcircuit on it. And every microcircuit has an inked marking. So for all DLA managed microcircuits, we are impregnating that ink with plant DNA. And again, you don't have to be a PhD to determine it. You get one of those little lights that TSA uses. You shine it on the ink. And if it doesn't flash a certain color, it's not a good component. So we're doing that, I want to say, with probably 25 to 35 of our microcircuit manufacturers. And we've had a healthy discussion with the microcircuit manufacturers over whether that's a good idea or not. But as the guy that's responsible for good components in the supply chain, this is not a fail-safe method, but I feel a whole lot better about the goodness of our microcircuits. If they flow through a system that either keeps them out to begin with, and the final fail-safe is, does it have that DNA mark? And of course, anybody with a light can be a counterfeit tester. So we started that about a year ago, and it's been pretty successful. So, and of course, we will expand that to other commodities as well. And again, this is not something we thought of. The cosmetic and the handbag industry has been doing this. Of course, counterfeits and knockoffs has been the bane of their existence. So this is a technology that they have used to great effect with lipstick and handbags and all that sort of stuff.
I was wondering, you've talked about your great relationship and partnership with FEMA and your efforts, DLA's efforts in humanitarian assistance and disaster relief. And we touched on a little bit of the challenges and a little bit of the efforts you've had in that area. What I'm interested in is, what are some of the lessons you've learned from this mission set that sort of made you change the way you approach it?
In my TRANSCOM days, I was out there as the deputy commander, and we went through, you know, the earthquake in Haiti and the earthquake and then the tsunami in Japan and then lesser sort of humanitarian assistance, disaster relief efforts in Pakistan and, you know, Africa and the Philippines, you name it. When it comes to disaster relief and humanitarian assistance, whether it's here or in the States, speed is of the essence. So, you know, if you're creating a logistics system, you can create it with a lot of attributes. Mm-hmm. But this one is, it's all about speed. Perfect information has no value in that. Roughly right is not only good, it's perfect, because again, it's all about speed. When you're responding to these disasters of sort of biblical proportions here, it takes you a little while to build a land and a sea bridge to Haiti to move 500 containers a day. it takes you some requisite amount of time to set up a supply chain that is going to pump 800,000 gallons of gas into gas stations in the five boroughs and Long Island. So speedy decision making is of the essence. And when you're a logistician, you know, again, I tell my folks, in these scenarios, I want folks out there making decisions. And you need to make them based on less than perfect information, but you need to make that decision. And if it's only half right, then so be it. So better to be on time and half right than 2 days late and 100% right. Mm-hmm. So it's all about speed. Usually it's not always all about speed. You don't want to be making sort of momentous decisions that involve hundreds of millions of dollars based on less than perfect information if you don't have to. But in disaster relief scenarios, it's all about speed. Mm-hmm. In fact, even if you're really fast, you're still late.
Yeah.
So that's my biggest lesson learned in terms of leadership. And I can't be making all those decisions. You know, I have a great J3 that fully empowers his crew to make decisions. I have a great acquisition organization that are basically writing contracts over the telephone. And that's what you got to do. That's what you got to do. So, again, that's my big lesson from humanitarian and disaster relief. The other thing I would tell you writ large here, that logistics is really not the science that a lot of people think it is. It's a, you know, our big tools are sledgehammers and fire axes, not scalpels and lasers. You know, roughly right for us is okay. When you're talking about nuclear weapons or the nuclear reactor, that's when you got to be precise in supporting those commodities. But, you know, the movement of great big commodities through, you know, to a place like Afghanistan, you do that with a sledgehammer. So you don't need to overstudy it too much. It's just get it roughly right and start moving.
What does the future hold for the Defense Logistics Agency? We'll ask its director, Vice Admiral Mark Karnacek, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. What is fast government, and how can focusing on time and speed deliver real and lasting benefits? How are VA and HUD working to end chronic homelessness among veterans? What is national health security, and how do we get there as a country? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. We bring you insights and interviews from government executives who are changing the way government does business. All of this and more in the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine. Download or order your free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Vice Admiral Mark Karnacek, Director of the Defense Logistics Agency. So, sir, I understand you have a regular face-to-face captains of industry meeting with key suppliers. Would you tell us more about that program and why does it exist?
Well, it exists primarily because the Secretary, in his guidance, defense planning guidance in January of 11, in addition to the pivot to the Pacific and what the ground forces are going to look like and all the force planning construct, he told DOD leaders to start talking to industry. And the impetus for that was that with all, you know, the Budget Control Act and the looming specter of sequestration here, that there was going to be a lot of anxiety with our supplier base with regard to what that all meant to them. So rather than have them try to guess what that meant, he said, get out and talk to them. So that's what we're doing. When you buy a lot of stuff like DLA does, you know, our relationship with industry takes place at two levels. It takes place at the contracting officer level, where that's the legal agreement that says the sort of the quid pro quo of what the supplier and the customer will do. But it also needs to take place at the strategic level with my counterparts in private industry. And it has to take place at both levels, because if you don't, your suppliers don't know who to talk to other than the contracting officer. So Mr. Kendall's a big one for that, too. His Better Buying Power says, get out there and talk to industry. Not your lawyers, not your contracting officers, but you there, Mr. or Mrs. or General or Admiral, whomever running a big acquisition organization, get out there and talk to those folks with regard to what your expectations are. Because DLA is a big acquisition machine, and we will rise or fall with regard to savings on our acquisition processes, who better to ask than our suppliers to help us save $13 billion? Again, this is not an attack on their profit. It's an attack on cost, which we both don't like, right? You know, a lot of the initiatives that we're now doing came as a result of these captains of industry meetings, where I would meet with my counterpart at Boeing, in the food industry, in the petroleum industry, the natural gas industry, you know, medical equipment, pharmaceuticals. A lot of the great ideas have come from them. What should the contractual instrument be that achieves that operational outcome at the least cost? Mm-hmm. Well, award contracts faster. You know, if it's taken you 400 days to award a long-term contract, that takes too long. In private industry, we normally do that in about 140 days. So things like that, payment terms, how quickly you get paid. So if I'm willing to do something, I expect something back from them with regard to delivering products that cost less than they did before. And plus, it's just good to have that relationship with your counterparts in industry. So that's really all it is. And we do that about every 6 months. So we've been through all of our supply chains, most of them twice now. So we collectively decide what it is that we're going to go after, the 3 to 5 big things we're going to go after as the government and the industry, and then we hold ourselves accountable to do them.
So, Admiral, the success of your organization, DLA, rests on the experience, training, and expertise of your team. Yep. I'd like to explore a little bit about your workforce development initiatives. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I have a great J1. His name's Brad Bunn, and we have a great, highly skilled workforce. Often I hear a lot of folks who sort of bemoan the fact that the average age of a DOD civil servant is 48. Well, I'd rather have a 48-year-old than a 28-year-old. And it's not that I have anything against youngsters, but I'll take that experience any day because they've seen it all, they've heard it all, and they know it all. So in terms of the vintage, I think we got it exactly right. And it's been 48 for a little while. So whoever, either by design or by luck, keeps that workforce at right about 48, and that's my J1, that's exactly right. We spend a lot of time on training, mm-hmm. so we don't just throw people into the fray and just hope that they're sitting next to somebody who really knows what they're doing and they're well-trained. We spend a lot of money and a lot of time in my J1 organization recruiting the right people, recruiting a diverse workforce, and then once we get them, you know, a training program that happens over their first 3 to 6 years that really gives them the tools to know what it is they're doing. We have lots of opportunities for off-duty education, courses, bachelor's degrees. We send quite a few folks to get their master's degrees. We send folks to the Industrial College of the Armed Forces. Telework is a big one. A lot of our work can be done at your kitchen table just as well as it can be done here at our headquarters. So I'm not sure we're leading the league, but we're out in front with regard to telework. And that was sort of a big epiphany that folks had to have, that who didn't think unless they could see the person, nobody was working. And we have found that not to be the case at all. So a lot of work on the professional development side, very sort of forward-leaning with regard to telework. And on the fitness side, we give all of our employees 3 hours a week to work out. So if you're in the military, you better be a sort of a fitness fanatic, or you're not doing your job. And I find the same goes for our civilian employees. So if I want them to perform and at times work really hard, we need to give a little bit to make sure that they have time to make sure they're physically and mentally ready to do that. And we've had great luck there. So, and I've been in a lot of organizations that had a lot of civilians, and I would tell you RJ1 and his folks that do professional development and training and all of our dealings with our great workforce really do a great job. So I think what you'll find at DLA is folks that are generally pretty happy with regard to work environment. They're fully empowered to make decisions, that we expect them to go do things, and they have the tools and the training to do that.
So, Admiral, I'd like to transition to the future. Mm-hmm. What are some of the major challenges and perhaps opportunities DLA will encounter over the next couple of years? And how do you think your organization will evolve to meet those challenges and seize those opportunities?
Yeah, that's a good question. Obviously, we've talked about money till we're blue in the face, so that's going to be a big challenge. But like every other challenge that the DOD faces, we'll rise to that occasion and we'll just be great at it. But we're just going to have to work hard at it. In terms of what DLA looks like, again, I've been a customer of DLA for a long time. And the DLA that I experienced as a youngster 36 years ago is a much different DLA than it was years ago, both in terms of scope, where we are, and our mission. So we have a vastly increased mission set